then we have to delay payment to providers until the next fiscal year, which has a direct impact on the ability for them to serve people.
State Health Department officials work to make their case for supplemental Medicaid funding. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, higher oil prices are good news for state coffers, but will it continue?
Holy cow, we're above 70, almost at 75, right? You know, fire the gun, let's start running.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
The Alaska legislative session could be coming to an end. House Speaker Bryce Edgman is a Democrat from Dillingham. He says his goal is for lawmakers to leave Juneau soon.
I'm doing everything I can to make that a matter of days and not weeks.
A major piece of the end of session talks is a bill to draw from Alaska Permanent Fund earnings to pay for state government. The conference committee on the bill is scheduled to meet Saturday. Edgman is optimistic about another piece of legislation that would ban smoking from workplaces.
I personally support it, and I want to see it pass, and it's my expectation that that will be the case.
Both Edgman and Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon say the session's end has been delayed by the complexity of the bills lawmakers are working on. McKinnon says a rewrite of the state's alcohol regulations as well as workers' compensation laws are still possible.
Right now, I'm optimistic. It's like a roller coaster here, though. Today, you're all going the same direction, and then you find, you know, an amendment somewhere that might throw a brick in the road. But we're trying to make sure that those bricks are talked about instead of fought about.
One area of difference that could be an issue is Medicaid spending. How much to spend on Medicaid has been controversial throughout the session. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on why that issue is back in front of lawmakers.
Governor Bill Walker's administration asked for $92 million to cover Medicaid costs that weren't budgeted for this year. The legislature funded $45 million of that earlier this session, but they haven't budgeted for the rest, and payments for Medicaid claims will stop in mid-May if the legislature doesn't act. Shonda O'Brien is the Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services.
If the supplemental is not passed, if we don't get the additional funding for the supplemental for the current year, that payments will have to be pushed into the next fiscal year, which then creates an even greater shortfall for us in the next fiscal year.
And the Senate has already proposed cutting $70 million from next year's Medicaid budget. O'Brien says if the legislature doesn't budget the supplemental money, it could cause funding problems for healthcare providers, ranging from smaller hospitals to providers in areas like opioid addiction treatment.
Then we have to delay payment to providers until the next fiscal year, which has a direct impact on the ability for them to serve people. Some of those providers might have to close their doors and go out of business.
Senator Anna McKinnon says the department must take steps to reduce costs.
The department needs to figure out that we have a budget crisis going on, and they need to get their house in order.
But department officials note the costs are driven by mandates the legislature has given them. So Medicaid spending is one of many moving pieces that lawmakers will discuss in the session's closing days or weeks. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Oil prices are up again. Alaska North Slope crude jumped above $70 per barrel 2 weeks ago and has stayed above that mark. While that's several dollars higher than state economists predicted, it doesn't mean the budget is saved, and it doesn't mean oil prices will stay higher. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more from Juneau.
Oil prices are inching up. A dollar here, 50 cents there. It adds up fast for the state.
You know, once you're into the 70s, you're getting maybe $80 million or so of additional revenue for each dollar of oil price increase.
That's Dan Stickle. He's the chief economist for Alaska's Department of Revenue. Each year, his department puts out a forecast for the price per barrel of oil, and oil prices are well above that forecast right now. But in Juneau, lawmakers are still leaning toward balancing the budget using money from the permanent fund's earnings. That's because prices are still well below where they'd have to be to fill the $2.5 billion hole in the state's budget. Stickle says if the legislature does decide to draw from the permanent fund's earnings, $72 per barrel is right about the sweet spot for balancing the budget.
So right around current prices, yeah.
But the effect of oil prices on Alaska's economy is much broader than just its impact on state spending. Musin Gitabi is an economist with the Institute of Social and Economic Research in Anchorage. He says another pressing question is how the uptick in prices could affect jobs and capital spending in the private sector. That is, money that companies spend on property or equipment or to take on new projects.
Obviously, nobody knows the exact answer to that. I think that what we can say is firms have adjusted to lower levels of employment. And so how quickly will they ramp up in terms of adding employees is, you know, the really million-dollar question.
That's the million-dollar question. Alaska is in a recession. And what will it take for companies to start hiring again, to pump more money into local economies? The thing is, oil development economics are dramatically different between fields. It's not as simple as producers turning the spigot on and off whenever the math works out in their favor.
Hello?
So I called Glacier Oil and Gas Chief Executive Officer Carl Giesler. Glacier is a smaller, independent oil and gas company in the state, so its economics aren't necessarily the same as those of ConocoPhillips or BP. But Giesler says there are some fundamentals to the relationship between oil prices and companies investing in Alaska. He says to get an idea of why companies haven't rushed to hire more workers or bring more fields online, it might be helpful to look into the future. Well, oil futures. Basically, oil futures are these contracts that allow traders to buy and sell oil that will be delivered months or years later. Giesler says this becomes kind of a prediction for what the price of oil could be.
The punchline is that even though oil prices are up meaningfully over the last 3 months or so, people are still cautious.
One reason they're so cautious is that when you look at oil futures, long-term prices don't look so good. Giesler keeps calling it backwardation, though after I tease him about using $10 words, he explains that it just means that the future price is less than the current price.
And that backwardation is the one thing that's giving a lot of companies pause before they really start ramping up drilling, before they really start ramping up hiring, and before they sort of jump in with both feet.
To be clear, Giesler says these jumps in oil prices are good news.
I mean, holy cow, we're above 70. We're almost at 75, right? You know, fire the gun. Let's start running.
But Giesler says maybe don't run very fast because it could be a long race to consistently higher prices. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
It's massive. It would change the Kuskokwim, and you only have 30 days to read it. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers released its final environmental impact statement on the proposed Donlin Gold Mine today. Anna Rose MacArthur has more.
The hefty document totals more than 10,600 pages, and the public has 30 days to submit comments. The draft version of the document was half that size, at just over 5,000 pages, and the public had 6 months to comment. Half those months were added by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers after a public groundswell demanded the extra time. The final statement is supposed to take all those comments into account. The document's project manager, Jamie Hyslop, was not able to be reached today for comment. He is out of the office for training and returns to his desk Monday morning. The final environmental impact statement is meant to list the potential and perceived environmental impacts of the mining project, which would extend hundreds of miles in multiple directions across southwest Alaska. From a natural gas pipeline stretching between Cook Inlet and the upper Kuskokwim River to barging along the Kuskokwim, and, of course, a mine site near the village of Crooked Creek that would cover thousands of acres. Comments on the document are due by May 29th. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, students in Haines team up with puppeteers for an inventive First Friday performance.
Some really imaginative stuff that you would not see from adult artists, and it's much more interesting.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Each semester, undergraduate students at UAA are learning through hands-on research experiences that take them outside the classroom. Working alongside faculty and professionals in the field, students have used their research to begin exciting careers, to secure patents for their inventions, and to earn national academic accolades. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA.
Former State Senator John Torgerson has been appointed to run the Denali Commission while a search is underway for the organization's next leader. Torgerson, reached by phone at his homestead in Kisilov, says he expects to be in the job for a few months and says he's not interested in having the job on a more permanent basis. Torgerson was elected to the state Senate in 1994 as a Republican. He was chairman of the Resources Committee during pitched battles over subsistence. Torgerson later served as a deputy commissioner of transportation and chaired a redistricting board. The Northwest Arctic Borough's Village Improvement Fund could start distributing money for local projects this year. A group of representatives from each of the 11 borough communities met this week in Kotzebue to define criteria for the projects.
It can't be directed toward one entity or one person. It has to be something that's sustainable and it is shared with all the community.
Hiram Walker is the capital projects manager for the fund. He says the fund is currently at $12 million. It was set up last year as part of a 10-year agreement between the borough and Tech Resources, which operates the Red Dog Mine. Tech is contributing $4 to $8 million to the Village Improvement Fund each year out of zinc mine's profits. Walker says the fund will provide not only a reliable funding source to communities where outside money is scarce, but also local autonomy.
We'll be able to hire local. We'll be able to buy material from whom we want to buy it from. It's a government thing, but it doesn't have very many strings attached.
So far, Walker says, Deering is the farthest along in putting together a proposal specifically for piped drinking water. Selawik and Ambler are also hoping to receive funds in the first round. Selawik VIF Commissioner Tanya Ballett says her community is hopeful to get funds to either complete a new store, construct a new landfill, or improve water and sewer. Ambler Mayor and VIF Commissioner Morgan Johnson says his community's priorities include water and sewer improvements, addressing high energy costs, and a lack of adequate housing. But deciding what to focus on will be a group effort.
People will have to come in, you know, sit down and work things out as a community. Everybody get in one mind and just say, hey, what's the most important thing that the town needs right now? And go for it.
Whatever they end up choosing, Johnson says the program is a big help.
It's a pretty smart move for Tech to help borough in any ways to help alleviate struggling communities that don't have funding of any source.
Tech will contribute $8 million to the fund in 2018 based on their 2017 profits. Once the commission has nailed down specific criteria, it will start to look at community project proposals. When people think of Alaska seafood, salmon and halibut come to mind. But the state also produces a lesser-known fish product sought all around the world. Surimi, the base for imitation crab. Now the guy who helped establish surimi in America more than 30 years ago is on a mission to improve how it's made. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has the story.
Tyree Lanier is a food scientist at North Carolina State University, where he's been since the 1970s. He has a background in the science of hot dogs, so working on seafood initially was a bit of a stretch for him.
I started off trying to make hot dogs out of fish, believe it or not, and then I heard about this product called surimi.
Or, as Lanier refers to it, the hot dog of the sea. For thousands of years, surimi seafood has been part of the Japanese cuisine. It comes in a variety of flavors and shapes.
There are forms that look like marshmallows. There are forms that look like noodles.
You probably know it as the fake crab meat in most California rolls. But until just a few decades ago, you could scarcely find surimi seafood in the United States. Lanier says there were a few reasons why early 80s America seemed ready to adopt a version of the food. One of them was the king crab fishery in Kodiak was on the verge of collapse, and the food industry was in a race to supply an alternative.
And so they said, okay, here's this imitation that looks very much and tastes very much like king crab. We can't get king crab. Let's bring this stuff from Japan and flood it into that market.
But there was also huge potential to produce surimi domestically from pollock in the Bering Sea. First, the state's fisheries would have to come on board. Lanier went to Alaska to talk about that possibility. Hot dog of the sea or not, surimi didn't get a warm reception.
It was basically like, what is that stuff? And we will never do that in the United States. And I knew that it was going to be done here because we were buying all this imitation crab and it was just taking off like a rocket.
Eventually, though, companies came around to Lanier's way of thinking, and the first surimi processor opened in Kodiak in 1985. And now, decades later, Lanier has another big idea for Alaska. He says surimi plants are losing profits down the drain, literally. Around 40% of the soluble protein from the surimi-making process winds up in the water.
Whether it's good or bad for the environment, I'm not qualified to say. But whether it's good or bad for food waste, it's terrible.
He says that wasted product could account for upwards of $60 million of savings each year. Then there's the impact on the ocean. According to Alaska Sea Grant, the surimi wash water can form an oxygen-depleted goo and smother marine life.
You can look at Google Earth and look down on the vicinity of any surimi plant, and some of these are quite large. And on a given day, if they've taken the picture right, you'll see a big white cloud in the water.
So to reduce waste, Lanier helped develop a technology to recapture the solids.
Well, imagine making cheese. Okay, you make cheese and you get curds and whey, like Little Miss Muffet. Well, we're doing exactly the same thing. We have basically surimi whey.
And that surimi whey can be turned into a lower-grade surimi product. He says the water that filters into the ocean would run crystal clear. Trident Seafoods has already shown interest. And Lanier thinks for surimi producers, this technology is a win-win.
It solves many problems and it creates much more product for them. So now, from the same amount of fish, the same amount of money they've spent catching those fish, and they have a quota, so they can only catch so many fish, they can now make more product.
Lanier doesn't think that America's love affair with imitation crab will disappear anytime soon. And now there's a more efficient way of getting it to market. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at Matson.com. Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at AlaskaHeart.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, math and puppets. Some young artists will be displaying their work at an art gallery during an upcoming event in Haines. The show will consist of handmade puppets and sets. The month-long project is a collaboration between students and a local puppet group. KHNS's Daisha Eaton has more.
That's the sound of a recent puppet performance at the Haines School.
My puppet is Prince Nefarbi, the star of the amazing play, The Curse of Equasia.
That's one of the performers, 10-year-old Maddox Rogers, a fourth grader at Haines School.
He's this conceited prince in the beginning who basically has locked himself from the outside world and doesn't really know all the troubles which he doesn't have to deal with.
The prince runs a big corporation and is determined to cut down the last remaining tree to put in a parking lot. When his workers won't cut it down, Prince Nefarbi chops it down himself. And is therefore cursed and begins turning into a tree himself. In order to be free from the curse, he has to solve a complicated math problem. Rogers describes his puppet.
He looks very goofy. He has a yellow robe, a sort of royal brooch you don't see too much.
And a wooden hand.
Yeah, and a wooden hand. And his purple hat.
Prince Nefarbi is a complex sock puppet and one of the lead characters in the play, which students wrote with guidance from educators and a local puppet group called Geppetto's Junkyard. Students also made all the puppets themselves and designed and built the sets, including 11-year-old Marina Lowen, whose papier-mâché and modeling clay puppet also had a leading role.
She's the nature goddess. She's kind of like the Greek goddess Athena, except she doesn't do the hunting thing.
The fifth grader describes the puppet she designed.
She has the head of a fox and the paws of a fox, and she has a human body, and she has gigantic fangs.
10-year-old Sierra Oaks was responsible for another of the play stars.
Little Red Riding Sock. It's based on Little Red Riding Hood, actually.
Hers is also a sock puppet.
She has brown hair, and she has googly eyes, well, obviously. She has a red cape, and I guess she's a sock.
About 20 students participated in the project after school. Librarian Lee Horner helped spearhead the student-centered learning project.
We let the children explore different types of puppetry. We started with sock puppets and hand puppets, marionettes, and then they got to decide what they wanted to do.
Students started working on the puppets in January and then wrote the script and built the sets, resulting in several performances at the school in April.
I was really impressed with the level of imagination and just talent and skill.
That's Hannah Bogart, who grew up in Haines and left to study theater in Washington State. She's been working with Geppetto's Junkyard.
Geppetto's Junkyard is a puppet troupe that's been functioning in Haines for about the last 10 years. 10 years, I think, as of this year. And we are kind of a rotating collective group that devises and creates original puppet shows. We, for a long time, were doing two a year, both in Haines and in other communities around Southeast.
Bogart worked with the students a few times a week over several months.
A large portion of the time was taken up with building the puppets. Puppets first, and then we, from the puppets, built the script around that, which is an interesting way to do it, where you start with your characters first. And then, once the script was built, we started working on sets.
She says it was a lot more than just a puppet show.
They started with nothing, ended up with an entire world, with people that they had created, sets they had created, a script that they had written, and it paid off. So I'm hoping it will bring forth a sense of accomplishment and what you can truly accomplish if you start something and you don't give up.
The puppets and sets will be on display at the Arts Confluence Gallery in Haines during First Friday on May 4th, and the sets will remain up for some time.
Some really imaginative stuff that you would not see from adult artists, and it's much more interesting. I honestly believe kid art is much more interesting than adult art because it doesn't suffer from any kind of self-consciousness. For people that don't usually come out for First Friday, this is something different, so I'd really strongly encourage people to come out and take a peek.
Maddox Rogers, who played Prince Nefarbi, says he learned a lot from the project and wants to do more plays and puppet making. As for Prince Nefarbi, by the end of the play,
he has learned that it isn't always about yourself and also pay attention to math class.
The project was funded by a grant from the Haines Community Foundation and the Rasmussen Foundation through the Arts and Education Fund and administered by the Alaska State Council on the Arts. In Haines, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Now it's time for 49 Voices, and we're staying in Haines with Carol Waldo. Waldo owns Glacier Bay Farms, which is set to become one of the first pot businesses in the city. 70 years ago, she left Iowa with her family and drove up the Alaska Highway.
I never really asked my parents for sure why they came to Alaska, because it was a long ways from home. My dad was in the Navy, and when he came back from the war in November of 1945, I think he He had seen some of the world, and I think after the war, there just wasn't any jobs, and he heard there were jobs in Alaska. My mom worked all during the war, and my grandmother took care of us, and my mom saved her salary, and so that was, we had enough money to live for over a year without my dad doing anything. There were three of us when we came to Alaska, my older brother, my younger brother, and myself. In the years to follow, there were three more children born, and so you have to remember that was a time of like polio, and there was no polio vaccine. A lot of kids were coming down with polio, and I think they thought living in a smaller community, kind of isolated like Haines, that there was a healthier environment for the kids. But the road was terrible, and there were very few places to stay, and most of them weren't very clean. So they bought a tent and sleeping bags, and we camped out. They cooked their own food, because a lot of those roadhouses were, they had bed bugs and fleas and you name it. Arriving in Haines was kind of a cultural shock because the town, there was only about 300 people. I never heard my parents complain about it. I never heard them say it was a tough trip or anything. They just, I don't know. They had survived the Depression and the war. I guess they thought we were on vacation. I don't know.
Carol Waldo lives in Haines. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Daisha Eaton and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Rasha McChesney, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, and Gabe Colombo in Nome. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. The Alaska Native Village Corporation Association's 10th Annual Conference and Board Meeting is May 10th and 11th in Anchorage at the Egan Center. Learn about new developments and opportunities from Alaska's business leaders. Network with Alaska Native Corporation executives and hear from the nation's top figures in Native contracting and small business. Agenda and registration at anvca.biz. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.